Welcome to the Phoenix Cast, a podcast about cybersecurity, technology, and innovation issues in the military. We are your hosts, John
and Kyle.
I'm a U.S. Marine, and the opinions expressed on the cast are my own, not official military policy.
And the opinions expressed by me are also my own, not those of my employer or any other businesses I happen to be associated with.
For today's episode, we're joined by special guest, Captain Pete Piscucci. Pete, thanks so much for coming on. Could you give us a quick intro?
Well, gents, thanks so much for having me. I'm a member of the Navy Judge Advocate General's Corps and have spent the past 19 years advising military commanders on the conduct of operations. Some of my previous assignments include tours in the DoD Office of General Counsel, Chief of National Security Law for U.S. Cybercom, and then the Deputy Staff Judge Advocate at U.S. Special Operations Command. I should mention I'm also an adjunct faculty at Georgetown Law, where I teach the legal aspects of state cyber operations and responses. And like John, as a military officer, the views that I express are my own and do not necessarily reflect the DoD or Navy policy or views.
I love this. And for all the listeners out there, I have been waiting for this episode for a long time. I am a closeted cyber legal nerd. I find it to be one of the most fascinating elements of all things related to OCO and DCO, or offensive cyber and defensive cyber operations, and the laws and precedents that set what we can and can't do as a DoD versus as a civilian sector, as in all the different ways, is super awesome. So, Pete, we're super excited to have you here, and thanks for being on.
No, happy to be here.
Okay, before we get into the meat of this, though, I want to hit a couple scene setters. So, one, I believe you are the first Navy officer that we've had on the cast. So, a reminder for those who are not super conversant, for the other services, a captain is an O3, or the third officer rank in those services. In the Navy, they switch it up. So a captain is an 06 in the Navy, the same as a full bird colonel in the other services. So wanted to hit that one first. And then, so Pete, when you started the journey, did the Navy pin a ones and zeros badge on you and decide you do computer stuff as part of legal? Or is that something that came later?
Had to be a digital certificate, right?
Yeah, we digitally assigned me this, right? That came later. I kind of stumbled into this mission field. I at the time was working for the Vice Chief of Naval Operations as one of his lawyers, and cyber law was just becoming a thing. They had just stood up U.S. Cyber Command, and so Navy was looking for someone who was willing to come and try this field out and start figuring it out. I was the guy who happened to have the right clearances and be in the right spot in DC at the time. And lo and behold, I'm here. And that was, gosh, that was about 12 years ago now. So it's been a while.
Okay. And is this something, as far as the Navy is concerned, is there a path for this or not? Is it kind of like, hey, now that you do cyber, like this is what you do, or is this just kind of another thing?
No. So, you know, I'll get in trouble with my Navy bosses here, right? This is, I'm still doing cyber and enjoying it because I've disregarded every bit of advice I've received for how to manage my career. Navy will tell you the best thing you can do is be a generalist, practice lots of different areas of law, know a little bit about it. I have chosen instead to focus my career in the national security law area. So I'm currently in my seventh national security law specific job and my third tour in cyber. And so that is not one that is normally what's recommended, but it's clearly worked out really well for me, and I'm just having a blast doing it.
Pete, it sounds like you'd have made an awesome Marine Corps warrant officer, for the record. Gotta just throw that out there. Ignoring everyone else's advice and blazing your own trail and being massively successful sounds perfectly in line.
No.
Okay, so bringing us kind of in line here. So what actually is cyber legal? And I guess, you know, post COVID, some people might be thinking like you pop up as a hologram, and instead of actually having to come into the boss's office, he just pushes a button and there's a hologram of you, like a cyber human. Or is it slightly different than that?
Yeah, it's a little bit different. As you can imagine, I spend a lot more time in the boss's office than I probably care to. No, there's no hologram. It really is about finding ways to identify and mitigate risk for commanders while enabling them to conduct operations, right? My job is to help the boss conduct the operations he or she needs to conduct in a way that complies with international and domestic law and aligns with their authorities and policy frameworks, right? So, you know, my job is really be a problem solver, help him identify those problems, solve those problems, and conduct the operations he needs to.
Pete, so how involved are you? And obviously, you know, keeping things general, how involved are you in day-to-day operations? Like, is this a thing where, you get handed a package and say, how can we do this? And you take months to figure out the answers and you cite all the citations. You have to go like defend it in front of a judge. Or is this mostly you in like a more tactical foxhole type scenario, whatever that version is in cyber?
Yeah. So I think it's a little bit of both, right? There are some times when there are really strategic questions and nuanced issues, and that does take some time to get right. But at the same time, the best way to do this is to be embedded as close as you can with the tactical units, right? And so the more time I can spend with the actual on-keyboard operators and let them explain to me what it is they're trying to accomplish, right? I'm never going to dictate how you do an operation or what the operation is. What I may help you with is working through your decision process and what's the best argument you can make that's going to help align you with your authority so that you can get after the problem more quickly, as opposed to, you know, kind of swimming around trying to feel your way. And so it can be a little bit of both. I will say even on the harder problems, you rarely, if ever, get months to work an issue.
So you've teed me right into where I wanted to go with this. And Kyle, you're going to be kind of my use case here. So put back on the chief warrant officer bars.
Oh, easy to do.
Right. So you got him back on. Pretend there's camis. We'll you know, clip your hair and you're back. Yeah, and
I got to shave the mustache. Right.
Okay, great. So you just found out a cyber incident occurred. Firewall is lighting up. You're getting a call from DISA like, hey, there's some weird activity. And your mind, I would imagine, immediately goes nerd stuff. So like checking devices, looking at logs, etc. And my guess would be talking to the lawyer is probably step does not exist in your mind. Is that accurate?
All right. So if I get in the DeLorean and I go back to when I was a warrant officer and I had a network that I was maintaining, you know, it on the net, if you will, I likely would have done that. Full disclosure. Right. I would have grabbed my staff and COs and I would have been like, yo, where's the logs? What are we doing? What ports do we need to lock? Do we know, you know, can we run the vuln scans? I'd get with IA and et cetera. I like to think that I wouldn't be a young chief warrant officer two anymore. And I'd hopefully have gained a little bit of knowledge. And I would have, you know, grabbed the staff and COIC and said, you go do that. I'm going to coordinate fires at the highest level. And I'm going to make sure that I get with legal. I'm going to make sure I get with the commanders. I'm going to make sure I get with this and basically run comms at that point for incident. You know, sitting back on the chessboard and deciding where the pieces need to go, not necessarily getting into those fights. And ideally, Pete, I'm not sure which chess piece you would represent, but at a minimum, the bishop, I would say, but making sure that they are in play and actively advising.
Yeah. So my goal is not to be the pawn on the board, right?
You know, that's what I'm saying, right?
That's kind of the goal here.
Yeah. I don't know if it's king or queen, but like bishop is right there.
Yeah. And so I'll be honest, the lawyer in me actually likes your CWO2 answer of I'm going to go and get this stuff, you know, fixed and dealt with, right? Because from a DCO perspective, that's where we've got the most robust authorities, right? And you should be looking to immediately stop an adversary, right? And so really in the DCO side, when I get more involved is when we now want to start to unpack, no kidding, where is that adversary? Has they moved laterally through your network into other networks, right? And so now when we start branching out just from that one network you're worried about, into other networks, let's say across the DoD, that's when we start looking at authority lines, what our, you know, data management strategies are going to be, and therefore helping commanders ensure that they've got the requisite authorities they need to conduct those operations. And so, you know, I like your immediate response answer, right? That makes all the sense in the world to me. You know, and so don't call me first, you know, get your port shut down first. You know, give me a call when you're calling up the higher headquarters. And at that point, when you start working your strategy for how you're going to clear that adversary out, that's a good time to start bringing me into that conversation.
And Pete, to go along that line then, so would this be mainly, is cyber legal mainly a DCO thing? Or do you actually have some play in DODIN, which is the Department of Defense Information Networks. So think like a service provider for all the different services. And then in OCO, Offensive Cyber Operations, does cyber legal have a play in both of those realms? Or are you mainly just a DCO thing?
No, we've got play in all of those realms. I will tell you that the DODIN play for the lawyers is a lot like the DCO play. And so it's really about looking in terms of how we are expanding out, how we are looking to maneuver across multiple networks, and there's some legal issues that can come into play there. The larger legal play is actually on the OCO side of the house, right? And so it's when you're going after that adversary in an offensive manner, right? That's when we have to start really working through what are those applicable international legal obligations that, you know, we have to follow? What are the various domestic law frameworks we have to follow for how we are conducting those military operations overseas against adversaries?
And if you were talking, say, I don't know, right into the headphones of someone who is one of those Doden Ops folks or one of those DCO folks, and they're thinking to yourself, I just heard him say that, and I'm wondering, like, how do I use this information? What advice would you give them of how do they know when to call you, when to solicit you, and the best way to make that kind of work within their job roles?
Yeah, so I would say the first and probably the easiest thing is, right, most of your DCO players, you've got a set of standard kind of pre-planned responses that you're going to execute when you see various kinds of things, right? Be it some kind of anomalous activity, be it some kind of untoward thing occurring. And so as you're building out what those kind of PPRs are going to look like, talk to us then. We will help you figure out when's the, you know, right time to give us a shout and let us know how we can help. I will tell you, whenever in doubt, just call, right? We are ops lawyers. My team knows this. We take calls all hours, day and night. I don't care if it's 2 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday. If the operator has a question, we're going to answer the question at 2 a.m. on a Saturday, right? Because our job is to enable and support those operators. And that means we're doing it at a timing and tempo that they need in support of their mission. And so, you know, from a DCO perspective, the easiest is let's talk about it in kind of those pre-planned responses. But after that, I think it's really about understanding the client. And the more, you know, as a lawyer, you work with your operator, you build that rapport, you get a better understanding for what their priorities are. And then you can help them understand when's the best time to give you a shout so that you can give them meaningful support in a time that's relevant for them.
Okay. And I bet I know the answer to this, but is there ever a time they should not reach out to you? is there ever this, like, please don't ask me that question, or like, these are not the droids you're looking for?
Well, you know, as the lawyer, it's hard to say that, right? Because if I say don't call, then I don't get to bill you twice as much, right? So, you know, it's kind of the standard lawyer moment there, right? Yeah. No, like, I would say there's not something I would say don't call and ask, right? This is not one where plausible deniability is going to somehow help the situation. I would say if you ever have the question or if you're in doubt, just call. I would much rather have, you know, you wasted my time and an operator feel comfortable with the actions they're taking than not having made a call. And then we're trying to clean up something on the backside, right? It's a lot easier to get in front of things. Most of us can move fairly quickly on it. And, you know, it's pretty easy at times for me to be like, yeah, that's great. I don't care. Go ahead. You know, there's nothing I need to worry about here for you. Or there's more importantly, there's nothing you as the operator need to worry about here with what you're talking about doing. What I will say is that's a bit of a challenge, right? There's a bit of a chicken and egg at times, right? The operator wants to say, well, you know, what can I do? What's within my authorities to do? And the lawyer's going to sit there and say, well, what do you want to do? And why do you want to do it? And so the more you understand what you want to do and why you want to do it, that's a meaningful conversation because you will otherwise potentially self-limit. Right. If I sit here and say, well, the left line is here and the right line is there, you're going to sit there and say, well, that's where the lines are and everything I do has to be in there. But if you talk to me about what it is you're trying to accomplish and why you're trying to accomplish it, I may be able to tell you those lines are actually further apart than when you ask me to just define them in the abstract. Right. And so you can get more maneuver space and more operational kind of freedoms there by having that conversation early.
Yeah, and this is where I'll editorialize a little bit. I have both in kind of civilian roles that I have filled and also in military roles spent a bunch of time with cyber legal on both of these sides. And if ever there was a time for officership, if ever there was a time for very carefully and very thoughtfully wording your questions and responses, this is the time. I don't believe the lawyers look to kind of get to the definition of what is on a regular basis. However, the way you word it and the way you get after this thing, these things will produce very different results. And this is one of those areas where I think precision absolutely matters.
Yeah, John, you're absolutely spot on, right? That precision in language is so critically important, right? Not just because the lawyer, you know, I will find more words to describe the smallest of things because I think I can maybe I get paid by the word. I'm not sure. But it's really about driving to that precision because with that precision, what I'm really trying to do is one, buy down your risk and at the same time increase the operational flexibility. And so the more I understand with precision what you're trying to do, the more we can kind of help figure out how to get you a good navigation plan there.
Yeah. And if you want to shut down debate quickly, I asked the lawyers, they said no. Is normally when people don't want to entertain whatever your idea is, that is the fastest way to be like, oh, okay, on to the next topic.
Yeah. So I'll give, you know, the operators listening a little trick for you is when the lawyers say no, tell them to point to the actual law that's the problem. Right. So I will tell you, you know, my rule with my team is if we're going to say no, there's a legal objection, we're going to be able to point and sit here and say, here's the applicable international legal obligation or the U.S. domestic law that this action would potentially violate. And therefore, that's why we've got that concern. But make your lawyers actually answer with specificity. It'll drive them nuts, but it'll really help you from an operational perspective understand what the line is.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think I would also take that and I'd also say, as that kind of being specific that we talked about earlier, is saying, hey, I need to get here.
That's
sir,
right.
Or, you know, whatever the rank happens to be, I need to get here. Help me get there. And, you know, maybe you won't get the answer that you're looking for, but I think if you have good lawyers, you'll get an answer. And then you as the commander will deem whether that is acceptable or not.
No, I think that's right. There's a number of times where I've had to sit there and say, listen, you told me you want to get from A to B. Well, the law prohibits you from making a right turn, but you can make three left turns and I got you to the same spot, right? And so by, you know, that's that precision, right? What is it you're trying to do and why are you trying to do it? If you give us that, and then, you know, we'll work with you to try to find a way to get from A to B. And in many cases, it's not that you can't get there. It is most frequently, we just need to go ask so-and-so for permission, right? It's really about who can authorize those kinds of activities.
And Pete, when you're sitting in your office pontificating general things, is your mind generally kind of friendly focused? Are you more looking at your operators and the people on your team and kind of microscoping down on, are they allowed to do this like this? Or are you kind of a bit more enemy focused where you're saying, okay, well, the enemy is here. They're doing these types of things based on international law. You may X, Y, and Z. Or is it a little bit of combination of both of those?
Yeah, it's a little bit of combination, right? And so you've got to be enemy focused because you've got to understand what the adversary is doing, because the adversary's actions are going to oftentimes set, from an international law perspective, the outer bounds of what we can do. Let me use a real easy kind of kinetic example, right? If a country launches a missile at us, there's a lot of options for what the United States can do in response, right? If a country, you know, simply takes down the movies off of, say, Sony Pictures servers, you know, think back to 2014.
Very hypothetical.
Very hypothetical, right?
Right.
There's arguably less options available under international law in terms of a response, right? So you do have to have that enemy focus because you've got to understand kind of those outer limits. At the same time, just because the enemy does something bad to you doesn't necessarily mean that that's justification to do whatever you want in response, right? And so that's where you do then have to have that internal look, looking back at, well, what is it we want to do in response? And how does U.S. international legal obligations and domestic law frameworks apply to those particular planned activities, right? And so it's a little bit of a combination of the two. I will tell you, I start with what the adversary is doing, not with what we want to do, because generally speaking, those international law paradigms are going to be more challenging than the domestic law paradigms. And so that's why I just tend to start from that international law perspective.
Interesting. And so I have a sub question on this one. So you said kind of generally a little bit more enemy focused, but obviously both. And I kind of go to Senate hearings and some other things. And I just think what a nightmare that has to be, because I'm guessing, especially since you said you're doing a bunch of OCO stuff and DECO and Doden Ops. I mean, like, that is like the trifecta of nerd, right? So there is probably just so much technical detail, you know, IP addresses, MAC addresses, all the crazy technologies that were coming up here. And I don't in my mind picture the legal folks that I'm guessing you're bouncing this stuff off of as quintessential technology nerds or first adopters.
No, you're spot on that. Listen, you know, I struggle to print at times, okay? And so really what this comes down to, though, is being able to take – because think of it this way. The law is not written in ones and zeros, right? You won't find the phrase IP address in federal law, right? It's not that kind of structure. And law and policy are always preceded by technological advances. We can look at that over time, right? Look back to history. Take warfare, for example. We didn't have a chemical weapons convention banning the use of chemical weapons until what? After countries had employed chemical weapons and we said, oh my gosh, this is horrible. We don't as a world want that. And so we're going to prohibit it, right? And so law and policy are always outpaced by technology. And so what that means is that we are always having to take new and emerging technologies, particularly in cyberspace, and apply them to existing international and domestic legal regimes. And so as a result of that, right, I'm not going to sit there and pretend to, you know, fully, you know, I can't sit there and conduct the operations. I don't have the technical acumen. But what I do have is a really big whiteboard in my office and really smart folks who come in and do a nice job of drawing pretty color pictures with dry erase markers that help me understand it. And we convert that technical language into plain English, because plain English is what you're going to find in applicable law. Now, that's not to sit there and say I can be a total, Luddite, if you will, and have no knowledge of technologies and no understanding of it. But what we've got to do is recognize that law and policy is all predicated on the physical layer. And frequently you're coming in and talking to me about issues in a logical layer or a personal layer. And so we've got to figure out how we're going to extrapolate from there back to a legal regime that's predicated on everything based on a physical layer. And so there's a bit of a translation almost that has to happen. But it's not as complicated as I'm making it sound, because in the end, the basic principles are the same. Frequently, what you're talking about is what's the individual, you know, or unique technique or TTP or tool you're going to use to do something. But it's going to have a result of deleting data, blocking an access, you know, disrupting a communication. Okay, well, that's pretty straightforward. And now we can take that end result, that effect, and apply the applicable law.
And what would you say is your North Star when you get to confusing things? Because I can imagine, like, a very simple one. The IP address 192.168.1.10. Where would you say legally that is located? How do you go, just if that is a dumb example, how do you go about answering an unanswerable like that?
So I think the first thing I have to decide is, okay, there may be an unknown and it may be a known unknown, right? Which is what you're pitching. But the question is, for the planned operation that you all want to conduct, does knowing that answer matter? Right. And so, where it will matter is, for example, if we can sit there and say it's not in the United States, it's overseas. Well, that takes a big hurdle off, right? Because now generally speaking, don't have constitutional implications. I don't have conducting domestic military operation implications, right? And so that takes a whole batch of legal issues and allows me to go put them over here in a park.
Those guys don't worry about those guys.
I'm not worried about that, right? And so I can focus on other things, right? And so that becomes an important aspect of this. And so figuring out those known unknowns and figuring out if they matter can take the issues off the table. There are going to be some times when we're not going to necessarily know an answer until you're there, right? And so there's some operations where you may know that, you know, this particular server's got something nefarious on it and our intent is to go do something to it, but the location of that server may be obfuscated. And right, and sometimes you all may tell me, well, we're not going to know where it's, quote, located geographically until we get to it. But for operational security reasons, we don't want to touch it until we're ready to go do it. Right. And so that creates some challenges. And so now we're going to have a conversation of, well, what indicators do we have that, may be foreign versus domestic? So I don't know. Do we know what programming language it's in? Do we know what actual language like the GUIs are written with and so forth like that? Because if it's English, well, that's a strike against us. If it's, I'm just literally just making this up. If it's Italian, that probably helps. Right. And so none of this is perfect. And so one of the hardest things for lawyers that are new to practicing in this domain is to get comfortable with uncertainty, right? It is rare that my clients are going to come in and say, hey, lawyer, we are 100% certain of X, right? And in fact, you know, I'll tell you, when they do that, I kind of look at them a little bit funny, like, really? You're 100% certain, you know, do we really want to make that assertion?
Oh, yeah. That is my number one, like, and I'm nervous.
Right.
You're 100% certain in cyberspace?
Yeah. And so, you know, you've got to, for lawyers, it's hard, right? Because you want lockdown facts. Because once those facts are locked, then you feel very comfortable applying the law to it. Well, in cyberspace, those facts are not going to be locked, right? You know, network configurations can change in moments. And so what was, you know, it's not that you lied to me, it's the facts have changed. And, you know, the 20 minutes since you came in and handed me the con op and, you know, then I looked and gave you an answer. Now the facts have changed again. Well, you got to get a little bit comfortable with that. And that just takes some getting used to.
Okay. So one thing I've always kind of wondered, and it has been, I don't know, a decade plus that I've heard this, and it is the term authorities. I think authorities are the most nondescript, least clear topic since I have been a military officer. So maybe you can help us out here, assuming you know this. Like, what are authorities? And can I find an authorities vending machine, maybe on campus somewhere? And how do I pay for that? Is there a color of money that I need?
Yeah. So I think the key is the authorities vending machine only takes crypto. If only, right? Sorry, too early.
I like that one. Joke. I like that one.
I like the crypto joke.
Right, terrible.
Bad joke. I think the real issues are, so authorities really shorthand for a couple of things: assignment of a mission and permission to conduct it. Right. And so really in the military, that's what you're talking about with authorities is, have you been assigned a particular mission? And if so, do you have permission to go conduct whatever activities you're seeking to conduct in support of that mission? Right. And so there's any number of ways authorities flow in the Department of Defense. Principally, what we're talking about for these kinds of military cyber operations is you're talking authorities that come starting with the president, right? You know, little lawyer nerd moment, right? This becomes an Article 2 conversation. You will not actually find military operational authorities in cyberspace anywhere in 10 U.S. code, right? Anyone who does this in the military likes to hear Title 10, Title 15. We can have some wonderful lawyer semantics about that. But there's not actual operational authority in Title 10 to conduct military cyber operations. It all comes from the president. And so what you then have to look at is, what is the structure by which the president has assigned missions? The most common one that everybody knows about is the Unified Command Plan, the UCP, right? A new one came out this past April. It's unclassified. It's right in the Federal Register. It's pretty easy to see. And so that's assigned certain missions, for example, to U.S. Cyber Command, who then directs, in this case, General Nakasone directs his components to conduct those missions. And so within the orders to conduct those missions, it will say you can go do certain things. And for other things, you need to come back up to whatever level that may be. It may be at, you know, the cyber command level. It could all the way go be all the way going back up to the presidential level, right? It all depends on what the specific mission is. And so when folks talk about authorities, really what they're sitting there saying is, have I been assigned the mission? And if so, to conduct this concept of operation for that mission, do I have the permissions I need to go do that? Or do I need to get someone's permission? Does someone need to review the operation, assess the risk and say, yes, go do that, or no, don't go do that, right? That's really the conversation we have with authorities.
Okay. And assuming I'm a commander working with you, I'm going to come to you and I'm going to say, hey, I think I have these authorities. I want to do this thing. I believe it's inside this mission set. And then you'll give me a kind of like, legally, it seems like you're sound there. And then you're also going to give me a bounce on domestic and international law. Is there anything else you're kind of putting the calculus in there? Or is that
pretty much what it looks like? The other things I'll put the calculus in, right? So that's the core of my mission set, right? Sit there and say, yes, your operation aligns with authorities that you are holding as the commander, and your planned activities are, you know, within the bounds of both international and domestic law. That's kind of my core mission set. The other aspect of what I'm charged with doing is also looking at the policy aspects of things, right? It could be that there may be a DoD policy that says, well, before you do certain things, you need to coordinate with these 18 other people, right? I'm going to tell you that as your lawyer. It's not, if you don't do it, it's not like you violated federal law, right? I won't sit there and say it's legally objectionable, but my job is to also point out to you, hey, commander, you've also got this policy requirement that you're supposed to execute, right? And so I will inform you of that, right? It's important that your lawyer separate their legal advice and their policy advice, right? Because you as an operational commander, that's different risk tolerances, right? No one's ever gone to policy jail, right? No such thing. But
okay, can we quote you on that as a lawyer? Yeah.
No one's ever gone to policy jail.
Gone to policy jail. You heard it here.
Oh, I've committed that to memory already.
Yes, you have heard it here.
No one's gone to policy jail. But what I will tell you is you got to ask yourself, whose policy is it that you've just decided to ignore? And, you know, the way I phrase it before to commanders is, do you think you're still going to be in command tomorrow if you violate that policy? Not my call to make, not my decision to make, right? But again, think about what I said earlier. It's identifying risk, mitigating where possible, and then teeing up those risk decisions for commanders to take, right? And so that's kind of where we'll look at it as you propose something.
And so as I come to you with this and I bring you this packaged piece of information that we just talked about, and you eloquently kind of walked me through all that stuff and the risk that goes there, how can I, assuming that I don't want to make life painful for you, which big assumption, but so assuming I don't, how can I be a better customer for you? How can I get you the best product? What stuff should I stay away from? What stuff should I emphasize?
So, right, lawyers, generally speaking, we like words, right? That's a challenge in the military because everybody in the military likes PowerPoint pictures, right?
It is not wrong.
It's not, right? I get it. I get the slides are beautiful and they're pretty and they're colorful. What I will tell you is nothing beats a well-written con op, a well-written concept of operation that spells out, here's what we want to do. You know, it's almost like, you know, if you took a journalism class in school, right? It's the five W's and the H and the how, right? And so the who, what, where, when, how, why, we're going to lay all that out. And, you know, if you've got that well done, that's going to make it a lot easier for your legal team to sit there and look at it all and, you know, help you figure out, do you have everything in place you need to do this? Now, I'm not saying there's no good time for pictures, right? There are some operations where explaining it in words is great, but having, you know, one or two or three figures that kind of help walk you through it. You know, if there's a complex, I don't know, structure of the entity you're going after and how things nest and so forth, that's great. And that may be useful to have as a graphic, right? So I'm not opposed to pictures, but, you know, the idea that in cyberspace, you're going to have a con op that shows like a geographic map, a swoosh and an airplane on it and say, that's what we're going to go do is probably not going to get through your legal team.
I need my cyber to be the big blue arrow, right?
Right. Like, big blue. Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Cyber this comes over the hill and takes this.
I believe the cyber is probably the lightning bolt.
Yeah. I like that. You know, I can't recall. I want to say it was either the Army or the Marine Corps has come up with the little like symbols like you would put on the map, like that for divisions and battalions and everything. They have that for cyber. I've seen it before. And I'm sitting there going, that is not going to work in a con op with me. But, you know, I'm looking forward to somebody's going to bring it to me someday. And I'm looking forward to that one.
Ooh, challenge accepted. I will find someone to bring you a cyber ops term and graphic. That is now my personal mission.
I'm looking forward to that one. I am.
So, I mean, does this boil down to you need a 5-paragraph order? Just like, this is what I want to do. Here's all the players. Here's all the details. Here's the who, the what, the where, the when, the why, and the how, and what my goal is. Like, help me achieve that goal. Like, maybe the plan sucks and I need you to come in and give some sort of context that makes it suck less.
Yeah. So, you know, there is value in the 5-paragraph order. I don't want to sit there and say you need that in every single one, right?
No, because
that can get over the top pretty quickly. I'm a big fan of thinking about how do we structure kind of that 5-paragraph order from a framework perspective so that you can have multiple operations executing under it, right?
Right.
And so, you know, the last thing I want is to be writing legal reviews for every single little cyber activity you want to do, right? That's not good for you. It's quite frankly not good for me.
Right.
My team's not resourced anywhere close to that. And so it's really about thinking, how do we set those left and right limits such that you can do a range of activities within your authorities to get after that adversary, and in a manner that you as the operational commander are comfortable that as long as you stay within those left and right limits, you're good to go, right? And so that's the conversation I'm most interested in. And so that's where, you know, that good con op that can have, you know, multiple executions under it, to me is a really valuable tool.
How much back and forth are you used to having with operational commanders kind of pushing you or trying to get you to get there? What do those conversations look like? And what advice would you have for commanders that are wondering the best way to interact with their legal team, but also not just get to a place where it's always yes or always no?
Yeah. So first is fostering a culture of information sharing, right? I would rather spend countless hours sitting in meetings that I don't need to be at on the off chance there's something of value in that meeting that helps me, help you, kind of a thing, right? And so for me, the more information I've got, the more I understand your operational imperative, your priorities as a commander, the better chance I am to find that creative solution to help get after your problem, right? I said in the beginning, we like to, you know, as your JAG, I want to be your problem solver. I want to help you solve problems. And so I can't do that if I don't know where the problems are. And so I like a good interaction, you know, back and forth. I like commanders that sit there and be like, Jack, are you sure that's where the line is? Right? Like, you know what? Maybe I haven't looked closely enough. Now, where you got to be careful is, you know, I'm very comfortable being pushed back on, and I'm very comfortable still, you know, holding my own and saying, no, boss, that's where the line is. I'm sorry, I can't get you there. That's not everybody. And so it's really about trying to build that relationship and that understanding between an operational commander and the lawyer that's supporting him or her, right? Just to be able to have that rapport. You know, my current boss is great. He pushes back at me and challenges me. And I enjoy that. And I appreciate that fact. And at the same time, you know, when I look at him and say, boss, I can't get you there. I get a, okay, Pete, got it. Right. Like, and that's that. Right. And we've, you know, I'm blessed. It's my second time as my current boss's lawyer. And so it works out really well in that regard that we've got that kind of rapport. But there is risk here, right? There's risk that you end up in that scenario where it's always a no because they just don't want to be pressured, or it's always a yes because they've, you know, we in the lawyer community will say, well, they've gone native, kind of a thing, right? And so there's risks there, but that comes down to the professionalism of both the commander and the lawyer in ensuring an understanding of each other's roles and functions and a respect for each other's, you know, kind of mission and jobs there. Not saying they're on par, right? I get it. The commander's in charge, right? But the lawyer's job is to help that commander be as best as they can be.
Let's stay on that road. So with your, and we are talking about the best kind of commander legal team relationship with your predictive hat on, what does your OCC field look like further down the road? Does it look like it is today? Do you need to change that relationship around, or where do you think this is headed? What's the next big thing?
Yeah. So I think one of the challenges as I see it, is that we right now resource legal teams for cyber the same, you know, manner we would resource the legal team for maritime operations and those kinds of things. And the challenge with that is, you know, we've had the law of the sea, you know, and law of naval warfare since, I don't know, the days of sail. And so that's not the same with cyber. And so there's a lot more that is yet to be figured out, right? There's a lot more unanswered questions in cyber, which makes the legal issues more nuanced, more complicated, because I don't have that, you know, wall of books to go pull and read and sit there and say, ah, right there, page 37 is the answer. And I just tell you that, right? I can do that with law of the sea. I can't do that with cyber law. And so I think what we're going to need to see is, it sounds a little bit crazy to say, but I think it's going to be more lawyers. Because without more lawyers, what I worry about is our ability to be timely in our responsiveness to you and still providing the same level and caliber of answer. And so the only way I see you're going to do that is by increasing capacity there, right? Because with technological advances, you're going to start talking about, you know, AI and machine learning coming into cyber capabilities. We're already seeing some of that on the DCO side of the house, right? Where we're looking at automated decisions. And that's, you know, that works there. What I worry about is getting ready for what does that look like on the OCO side of the house? when you want to start having AI cyber capabilities to get after adversaries, right? There's a ton of legal issues there that are going to start even earlier, right? Because now we're going to have to talk about what's the data sets look like you use to train that AI? What was the testing you did on those algorithms? So now the legal questions that are going to support your operations are going to have to be answered earlier during capability development, as opposed to just once you've got that tool and you're ready to go ahead and employ it. And so that to me gets a little bit more complicated. You know, might I get replaced by ChatGPT? That's possible. Thankfully, I'm close enough to retirement. So, you know, I should be okay. In the end, I don't think that's going to happen. I think there's still too many things to program AI at this phase to replace the lawyers. Whether or not my daughter would have the opportunity to have this kind of a job down the road, I don't know. But, you know, the lawyers have always been good, over time about making work for themselves. And so I'm sure my occupational field will find a way.
If ever there was a thing to have confidence in, it would be that.
Right. We'll bill you extra too for it.
So, Pete, I want to ask a question that dovetails really nicely off what we're just talking about here. In general, knowing that you can't like go to the shelf and pull up the book and say chapter 7, you know, Smith v. Jones, 1988 or whatever, to have some sort of precedent or standard into this, how do you and your community set new standards? I'm trying to imagine that you're going to, at some point in the future, be able to say, I'm going to pick two random like countries here, like in France v. Mexico, cyber, 2023, right, we established the precedent for using AI-based attack algorithms or something, and therefore this is the piece. It feels like, and I know this can't be the case, but is it just like tribal knowledge, like you're passing down from one command to another command, or is this all contained in your brain, and when you retire in some point in the future, we will all be the lesser for it? Or how do you establish new precedent in this space, and what's the search function to find out who else is doing what?
Yeah, so what you've really just stepped on there, Kyle, is the biggest challenge there is, right? Which is, in a sense, it's figuring out what is, in this context, the U.S. government's position going to be on a particular issue, right? We've seen these questions be asked. If you go back to 2012, the National Defense Authorization Act for 2012, if I got the year right, Section 934 asked the DoD to answer, what is an act of war in cyberspace, right? Now, the lawyer in me will say act of war is a political question. The legal question is what is an armed attack or use of force, right? Because that ties to UN charter language. Act of war is the president prepared to respond as, based on that. But I will tell you, that was a challenge, I think for the department to answer then. If you look at the submission to Congress, it was kind of the, we'll know it when we see it, and aligns with what we see in the kinetic world. And while I think the lawyer in me, I think that's legally correct, the bigger question becomes, that's a very macro level question, right? If we get down to the whole, does this little action you're going to take amount to an attack? How much cyber disruption can you have before that is a prohibited intervention or a use of force kind of a thing? Those are very fact specific and detailed questions. And so that is precedent setting. That is in part why, the lawyers at times can't answer the question very cleanly or very quickly. And it's because we don't have 200 plus years of practice in this field, right? So I gave you the law of naval warfare before.
Yeah.
We know that you can bomb warships and naval auxiliaries in circumstances X, Y, and Z.
Right.
Because that law has been developed and tried and tested, and, nation states around the world have all accepted it over, millennia. We don't have that in cyber yet. And so I like to equate it right now to, imagine figuring out air warfare 5 years after the Wright brothers first took off.
Right.
Right?
Right.
You know there's questions, there's issues. And so you're proceeding deliberately, you're proceeding carefully, probably in some respects too cautiously for the operator's perspective. But you have to recognize that depending on how you pick something, how you answer a question, that is going to be precedent setting.
So, Pete, I have a quick question to follow that. If setting the precedent is difficult and takes time, how do you hold your peer group, or how does any cyber lawyer hold any commander accountable when and tongue in cheek, no one goes to policy jail, right? And these things are somewhat extremely muddy at times, and maybe only slightly muddy in the best of times, given that the precedent is tough and we don't have, you know, the law of admiralty or, you know, naval warfare. How do you balance that? Is it too sound of mind individuals in a room who are holding each other accountable to say, we can feel defensible about this, we have some sort of plausible deniability that we're doing the right thing here? Or like, what does holding someone accountable look like when everything is so unclear?
So I think that is why, you know, when we talked before about the authorities model, right, and it's about having a mission assignment and then the permission level, right? You know, you've seen plenty of reporting in the paper that talks about challenges associated with where permission levels are held and so forth. That's where that conversation happens, right? That's how that accountability model is executed, right? It's the, gee, you know, we're still figuring some stuff out. And so, you know, a senior commander may decide to withhold permission for an operation to his or her level because they want to manage that strategic risk at that level, right? That is the normal things that happen with command and control. You see that in the kinetic domain anyway, right? The more risky the target you want to strike, the higher level of approval that you have to get to do it, right? It's not that that lower level commander hasn't been given the mission to get after that particular adversary problem. It's that because of the risk associated with a particular strike activity, it's held at a higher level, right? And so it's the same kind of a concept in cyber, right? As you're figuring out the risks, as you are figuring out the legal issues, as you're figuring out kind of, you know, strategic and national policy decisions and implications, you're going to hold those operations that may implicate those things at a higher level, just like you would in any other domain. It's not satisfying to that tactical operator, but it's the practical reality of the government proceeding in a deliberate fashion to ensure that they understand the ramifications of decisions that are being made.
So this is obviously like a art style of question here, but how do you choose whether or not to communicate things like that? Because obviously you're thinking through this stuff. How do you personally make the decision of, I should talk to my next higher level because this may be precedent setting or blah, blah, yada, yada. And then obviously you want to balance that with, if every single decision goes up, your poor operational commanders are never doing anything.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of factors there. One, right? I think, you know, early in my career, I was told one of the big differences between an 05 and an 06 isn't technical acumen, it's leadership and judgment, right? And that's really what we're harping on here, is the leadership and judgment side. And so part of that is having an understanding of the strategic state of play and knowing when to exercise that. Part of it is having that relationship with your commander. So you understand, you know, I've looked at a boss and said, listen, boss, I think we're good here. But listen, this is really gray. I'm not sure how this one's going to break. We should probably have a conversation with higher headquarters first, right? Because again, I don't make the decision about conducting the operation. That's what the commander does. And so if the commander wants to eat more risk, that's commander's decision space, right? Most of the commanders I've advised over my career, if I sit there and say, hey, boss, this one isn't clean and clear, I think we should give higher headquarters a call, I will tell you, I have not once had a commander like me say, no, Pete, don't call your counterpart at higher headquarters, right? Every single time it's been like, well, go get them on the phone and you let me know what they think, kind of a thing, right? And so I think that's a large part of it. The last aspect to this, right, I think comes down to understanding the strategic state of play, right? So I talked before about, this is why, you know, I want to be in the room. I need to hear what the commander's saying. I need to understand what's going on operationally at the command, because you don't understand the strategic risk if you don't understand the adversary and the operations that are being conducted writ large, right? If you look at it as just your one little con op, well, that may be nothing. But, you know, if that con op is executing against target X and there's 14 other things occurring in the same AOR against the same adversary, now you have an aggregate risk conversation that may be vastly different than just that one little con op. And so you need to have that kind of wide angle lens.
I'm going to pivot us a little bit here because we're getting low on time and there's a couple questions I really need to ask you. So you can look at this two ways. It's either we're talking to Pete from, say, 20 years ago, or maybe one of the aspiring cyber lawyers listening to this. What do you recommend, since you've got the experience, you've got the operational wherewithal now, what do you recommend to them if they want to be the next you? And how do we, and actually, you know, in 10 or 15 years, I hope we have the opportunity to have a better, more polished track to get to where you're at. So what's your recommendation to start time now to get there?
Yeah. So one, nothing beats competence in the law, right? I am not a warfare operator, right? I don't have a warfare device on my uniform. I'm not a surface warfare guy. I'm not an information warfare guy, right? My job is to know the law. And so the number one thing I will tell any junior judge advocate to do is you need to spend most of your time focused on learning the law. That's why I'm on the staff, right? It's not because I understand risk. It's not because I can write an action memo better than anybody, kind of a thing, right? It's I'm there because I bring a specific subject matter knowledge. And so I'd start with knowing the law. The second is cyber exists in every other domain, right? In DoD, it's its own domain. But it doesn't exist in a vacuum from other domains. Rather, it is manifesting in those domains, right? It's a cyber effect that's going to manifest on land, on space, on a ship at sea, right? Any of those kinds of things, which means you not only need to understand the cyber law aspects of it, you need to understand the law of the sea, the, you know, land warfare, air warfare, right? Space warfare law. You need to understand those other areas of law because they're going to be implicated by your cyber actions. And so you have multiple bodies of law you need to know. And so first, it's really focused on the law. The second, get out of your office, right? Go spend time with the operators. One of the best bits of advice I got earlier in my career was to go sit with the operators, not even the planners. Go find like the E5 on the keyboard or who mans the crew serve weapon or whatnot. Because if you go sit with them and you ask them how their gear works and what they do, you will get great answers and more fidelity, right? That is how I've learned that, well, you know, sir, this thing does functions A, B, and C. But we found that if we connect this other antenna, we get another function D out of it, right? That is not going to be in the capability fact sheet anywhere. It'll just list functions A, B, and C. But I will guarantee you the first con op I get for that capability, function D is going to be what they want to use, right? And so understanding that, knowing about that really makes a big difference. And so getting out of that lawyer office and going and finding the operators, sitting with them, you know, getting to understand what makes them tick, how they think, how they view operations, that really matters. And then I think the third thing I would say is you've got to get in the game. Nothing beats actually doing it. Right. And so, you know, if you're a junior attorney on a staff and they're working a legal review, you want to be writing it. Yeah, you may have 43 other things to do, but you want to be writing this. And so put in the extra hours. Right. You didn't get to be a lawyer because you didn't, you know, because you didn't want to do hard work. And so it's time to camp and do hard work and understand that if you're doing an ops attorney tour, you are going to be working at times, nights, weekends. Right. Because what's your job? Your job is to provide legal support to the operational forces. They're working 24/7, 365. You need to be prepared to do the same thing. You know, and so that's the way it is. You know, the Navy jokes with choose your rate, choose your fate. It's no different as a JAG. You want to be an operational attorney? Awesome. I hope you like getting phone calls in the middle of the night because you should want the phone call.
I absolutely love that advice. I wish I could set up a video scroll where I could watch the commanders and sergeants major as I tell them, oh, hey, the judge is going to be spending a bunch of time with the Lance Corporals, and just watch the horror race over the face.
Their face. Yeah.
Listen,
yeah.
I was in 03. I was deployed with an expeditionary strike group in the Marine Expeditionary Unit. It was the 22 Mew. And so I spent more time with a bunch of, you know, E5s from 22 Mew teaching me all sorts of wonderful things about Marine Corps gear and how Marines operate. And so it was really formative for me as a young lieutenant. And so that to me has stuck with me throughout my career.
As a former 22 Mew Marine, I can say this explains so much.
There you go.
All right, last question before we call it here. What books or podcasts would you recommend for somebody who wants to get smart on the lawyering?
Yeah. Okay. So remember, no endorsement here. This is just, you know, random stuff I read. So start with some books, right? You need to understand some basic technology. I love tubes. I thought that was great. It gave me a great understanding of some basic networking stuff. From the lawyer side of the house, you're going to want to read the Talon Manual. I'm going to tell you the first thing to read is the foreword of the Talon Manual, which reminds you that it's written by a group of academics and experts. It doesn't necessarily reflect how states view international law. And so don't take the, just because you see a majority view in the Talon Manual doesn't mean you should assume that that's how your state or the U.S. views international law. But I think it's really helpful for lawyers to understand the various issues and the various viewpoints that surround those issues. And so I think that's a really useful book. Not a lot of other books in the grand scheme of things, right? By way of podcasts, obviously, you've got this one, which clearly if you're listening to, you're already scoring some points. On the lawyer side, I will listen to the Cyber Law podcast. It's by Stuart Baker, who's at Steptoe and Johnson. I'll listen to that one. I'll listen to the National Security Law podcast, which is Bobby Chesney and Steve Vladek out of the University of Texas. That's another great one. And so some things like that. The biggest thing I'll tell you is read. And you're not, law review articles are great. Books, not a ton in cyber here. But I'm a big fan of things like the Cypher Brief, Lawfare, Just Security, right? These are all blogs that tend to write about national security law topics. And one thing I will tell all your listeners is make sure you always check the bio of the people that are, writing these articles, right? I personally prefer to read stuff written by those that are in the game and doing it, because that comes with a sense of the practical reality side of how they interpret things and how they view things. Academics, pure academics are great, super smart. My only fear there is, it's one thing to look at a legal issue and think about it for months on end and write about it. It's another when, there's a 3-star with a con op who wants to know in the next 2 hours if he's good to go or not. Right. And so I like to have folks that have that academic credential, but a practical knowledge and practical side to them. I think I get more out of those kinds of articles.
Outstanding. Kyle, with the hardest job given to someone today, oof, good luck hot taking this one.
No, and I think Pete talked about this a little bit ago, and I'm going to use this as my hot take too, that we are operating in alone and unafraid at times in a place where there's not a lot of people who have gone before us in many ways. And at the speed and the evolution of the field that we are in cyber, in all ways, whether that's the actual technical side or the legal side, you got to understand that you need to be comfortable being uncomfortable at times. And remember that the burden of command is maintained through this process. To Pete's point, the ultimate responsibility falls upon the commander. So if you're a commander listening to this, realize that we love you and we trust you, and we're going to give you the best advice that we possibly can, both technical or legal, depending on our role and our billet and the place that we are going, that you trust us to do. But ultimately, if it's disagree and commit, by gosh, we're going to go ahead and do that. And we're going to back you up in every way that we can. But also, please trust that me, probably less than any of these other gentlemen on the podcast, have gone to school for this. We've trained for this. We've got deep experience pools in this. So when we say something to you, we're choosing our words carefully, and we hope that you trust us. But generally speaking, I love the fact that the burden of command is maintained by the commander, and that the ultimate responsibility still falls to the commander, especially in times of crisis or conflict or quote unquote cyber war. There's my hot take.
Dear listeners, thanks for joining us. You can connect with us on social media by going to Twitter and following at @USMC_TFPHOENIX. That's @USMC_TaskForcePhoenix. Our editor is Sarah Clarkson, and marketing support is provided by Jake Osborne. You can support the cast by going to Apple Podcasts and leaving us a 5-star review and accompanying comment, which you still need to do. And with that, we are out.